It is Friday, September 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, at least 22 people are injured in an explosion on London's underground.
It flew about 3,700 kilometers, flew to an altitude of about 770 kilometers, which is a little bit higher than previous tests.
North Korea launches another missile, and a new documentary explores trophy big game hunting. It's all ahead. Early Friday, an explosive device detonated on a London subway train during rush hour, injuring at least 22 people. I'm joined now by reporter Henry Ridgewell, who's in VOA's London Bureau. Henry, what's known about this bomb?
We don't know yet who placed the bomb inside the train. Police are working on two lines of inquiry at the moment. Firstly, going through security camera footage from the train and from the stations up and down the line to try to establish some identity for the attacker. Secondly, the device itself, it's thought, did not detonate properly. So police are left with some forensic evidence from the scene itself, which may help them identify who placed the attack and where they got the materials from. But so far, we don't have an identity for the attacker. So the manhunt is continuing, and it's believed the suspect is still at large.
This took place in an underground stop called Parsons Green. Is there any significance with the location?
It's not believed so at the moment. Terror experts I've spoken to seem to believe that, in fact, it was intended that the device may have detonated further into central London, and that would tally with the theory that the device didn't go off as intended. It's believed there was a timer attached to the device. Wires were seen protruding from the flaming bucket that was filmed by many of the passengers as they escaped the train. So the theory at the moment is that the attack was meant to take place deeper into central London, where the train probably would have been even more busy. And I think it's probably pure luck that we're not talking about a far more serious incident and loss of life today.
Well, London has been a frequent terror target just this year alone.
It has indeed. Five terror attacks in Britain, four of them in London this year, all of them targeting soft targets, as police use the term, pedestrian walkways, transport hubs, places that are very difficult for the authorities to defend against. They have put some measures in place. They have put barriers along some of the key walkways and bridges across the River Thames. There is an increased armed police presence in London. But it has to be remembered that millions of people use the London subway network every day, and its bus network and its road network. And I think everybody accepts that it's impossible to defend the entire infrastructure of the city. That being said, this was a bomb attack that will hopefully offer some clues and some leads to police where they will be able to establish if this was a lone wolf who perhaps got the instructions on bomb making from the internet or from some terrorist propaganda, or if it was part of a bigger terror cell. And that, of course, is the worst case scenario for authorities in London who may have to deal with the continuing threat. But as I say, the urgent task that they face at the moment is identifying the culprit and tracking them down.
Well, meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump has been criticized for his comments on Britain's approach to terrorism. What has been the response?
It's a difficult position for the British government. Obviously, they're keen to play this down and maintain their strong relationship with the United States. But this is something that also occurred in the Manchester terror attack that occurred earlier this year, where leaks on the course of the police investigation into the attack were forthcoming from the American side. And American media were reporting on the investigation, which British police believed was hampering their investigation. This time, President Trump seems to have told reporters in Washington at the White House that Scotland Yard, which is the headquarters of the Metropolitan Police here in London, knew the attacker. And so perhaps he knows more than is being let on by police here in London. The British Prime Minister was keen to play that down. She said there was no room for speculation and that authorities were working as hard as they can to identify the culprit.
Thanks very much, Henry. That's Henry Ridgewell in London. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, I'm sure there's a lot of response on social media.
There is, and particularly for this story, as Henry mentioned, photos of that bucket bomb circulating on social media. That was actually part of the first glimpses that we got at this bomb were from people who were on the train taking photos of it on their phones and then posting that to social media. And there's been a lot of reaction, not just in London or the UK, but really around the world, questions about where this attacker may have come from, who this attacker is. Was it a lone wolf? Was it part of a broader attack strategy? And part of that speculation coming from President Trump, as we just heard, tweeting out that another attack in London by a loser terrorist. These are sick and demented people who are in the sights of Scotland Yard. Must be proactive. Of course, Henry also talked about that President Trump alluding to the fact that Scotland Yard may have known who these people were. In the Rose Garden this morning, President Trump saying it was a terrible thing, that we have to be tough against terrorism, and he vowed to call British Prime Minister Theresa May. She has now spoken out saying that his speculation on Twitter is not helpful, saying that you need to wait for all the facts to come through. Of course, after that Manchester attack, there was some tense relations between the U.S. and the U.K. regarding that attack. But we'll end on a light note because it is the end of the week. The reason why President Trump was in the Rose Garden this morning was to meet a young man who was mowing the Rose Garden lawn. It was an 11-year-old boy named Frank Giascio. He sent President Trump a letter. He asked if he could mow the lawn at the White House. And President Trump said, sure. So this morning, Frank mowed the lawn at the Rose Garden. He got a visit from the president himself. Trump told reporters, this is Frank, and he's going to be very famous. So lots of activity about this on social media, including from White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. She tweeted out a photo of Frank saying that he's hard at work and doing a great job. And then after he finished mowing the lawn, Frank accompanied Huckabee Sanders to the White House briefing room to answer a couple questions. But a fun little story, nice for him that he gets to go there, a nice moment in the sun for Frank. But some confusion on social media because a lot of people saw these photos and said, why is there an 11-year-old child mowing the lawn at the White House? Did they hire, are they hiring child labor? What's going on? But once they heard the story, they said, okay, that's actually a really nice story that he got to go and of all things, mow the lawn. I can't imagine that would be the first thing I would ask to do is do some chores. But good on Frank for doing that. And the Rose Garden looked pretty spiffy. I saw some pictures after he mowed it. It looked pretty good.
Yeah, well, the White House, they're lucky just getting somebody say, I'll mow your lawn.
And hey, who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't want somebody to come by and do some chores? Absolutely.
Right. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. According to Syria, Turkey, Russia, and Iran have agreed to a safe zone deal. NASA's Cassini spacecraft takes a death dive into Saturn. A U.S. drone strike kills three suspected terrorists in Pakistan. And a Harvard dean reverses visiting fellow offer to Chelsea Manning. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists who sent a unique experiment up to the International Space Station have learned that bacteria can be quite adaptable in order to survive. A group of scientists led by researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder found bacterial cells, when treated with a common antibiotic in the near weightlessness of space, resorted to maneuvers such as shape-shifting to avoid being destroyed. Researchers cultured some E. coli bacteria on the space station and then exposed it to an antibiotic that normally kills it on Earth. They found that rather than being wiped out by the antibiotic, the number of microbes increased by 13 times and behaved in other ways that may have added even more protection from the antibiotics. Researchers say their findings have implications for those in space and on Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a look at Florida nursing homes in the wake of Hurricane Irma. Earlier Friday, North Korea launched another missile over Japan, just days after the United Nations imposed additional sanctions on Pyongyang for conducting its sixth nuclear test. The missile was launched from the Sunan district in the North Korean capital, Pyongyang, and flew over the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. I spoke with Ian Williams, Associate Director of the Missile Defense Program at the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies. I asked him what's known about this latest missile.
Well, we know its distance and its general trajectory. It did fly over Hokkaido, Japan. This was like the previous test on August 28th. It flew about 3,700 kilometers. It flew to an altitude of about 770 kilometers, which is a little bit higher than previous tests. And it flew for 19 minutes, which is interesting because that's quite a bit faster than the previous test on August 28th, which was about 32 minutes. That does suggest that we could be looking at something new, something different than the last test. We haven't gotten full confirmation on what the missile exactly was, but I would say that flight time does suggest it could be something different, but we'll have to wait to see.
Well, apparently this type of missile, it was capable of, say, flying towards Guam.
That's correct. That is correct, yes.
What do you think is the significance of this particular path that it took? Why did North Korea decide to send it in this direction?
Well, it does get a lot of attention when they fly over, you know, the territory of another country, of Japan in particular, given the hostilities between the countries. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, if you're looking at developing missiles, which they are certainly doing, based on North Korea's geography, if you want to fly a missile on a kind of operational trajectory, there's not many other places you can go. You can fly over China, which I don't think they would do. You could fly over South Korea, which would put it in the sights of U.S. missile defenses in South Korea and in Guam. So over Japan is really the only other direction that you can go. They could continue doing, you know, earlier in the year, they were doing a lot of lofted trajectories, meaning they would fly the missile very high, but not very far, and they would land in the Sea of Japan. But if you're developing missiles meant for combat operations, eventually you're going to need to see how they fly on a combat operational trajectory.
Does this most recent launch indicate that North Korea is just continuing to develop its missile program?
It certainly does. It wasn't a huge surprise to see that they did this again. Certainly, they seem to have a kind of a dual track, dual purpose, in my opinion. They're, on the one hand, looking to develop their missiles technologically, but they're also using their missile development programs and the timing of their tests, certainly to send a message as a way of objecting to certain things. Certainly, the timing of this test with the sanctions, the passing of the new sanctions, certainly not coincidental.
Ian Williams, Associate Director of the Missile Defense Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which is here in Washington. Power is gradually being restored in Florida following the onslaught of Hurricane Irma. Now, eight people died after the nursing home where they resided in southern Florida, lost power. I spoke with Kristen Knapp, Director of Communications for the Florida Healthcare Association. The nursing home, which is being investigated, has no connection with the association. I asked her about the regulations that nursing homes must comply with.
Nursing homes are required to have an emergency preparedness plan. They have that plan approved by their local county emergency management office. They are required to have an alternate source of energy. If they are caring for residents, for example, who are on ventilators, they are required to have a generator. Otherwise, the alternate source of power basically means something that they would have backup power to be able to monitor residents' temperatures, such as spot coolers or fans, to keep folks cool and just to maintain the health and safety of the residents.
What has it been like in the aftermath of Hurricane Irma? I mean, how have nursing homes been able to cope? I'm sure a number of them have been affected by this huge storm.
They have. You know, these caregivers across the state are extremely resilient. We have 683 nursing homes here in Florida. And as of Sunday, as the storm was making landfall and into Monday, We saw about 400 of those who lost their power. You know, we had 10 million Floridians in our state who were without electricity, and that continues. There's still folks today without electricity. And 51 nursing homes, as of this morning, were still experiencing power outages, not on commercial power. So it's been a challenge. It's really been a challenge. You know, they care for very frail, complex, you know, medical patients who require oxygen, medications. But again, you know, these folks, the caregivers that are making sure the residents are safe, are doing everything that they can. The Hollywood Hills story was a tragedy, and our hearts go out to those families. But, you know, that was an isolated incident, and there's so many wonderful stories about things that have gone right in this whole process.
And I would think it could the loss of power would affect food supplies as well, refrigeration.
Sure, exactly. For the last 5 days, we have been doing call downs to the facilities that are without power to check on them to see if they have the supplies that they need. We've got facilities that have power delivering ice. You know, those nursing homes that don't have power are working with their local officials to make sure they have adequate fuel supply, water. You know, their local vendors are pitching in, bringing additional supplies. So it's really been an all hands on deck situation.
Well, and at the moment, I know power is being restored, but I would assume there are still a number of nursing homes that don't have power.
That's true. Yes. Right now, the report we got this morning is there's still 51 nursing homes that don't have power. And again, we're staying in touch with those facilities to make sure that they have the supplies that they need to keep those generators fueled. They're doing everything that they can to keep the residents cool. You know, temperatures are hot in South Florida, and so their focus is on the safety of their residents. So they're looking at, you know, making sure they're monitoring those temperatures, doing everything that they can, bringing in additional generators, spot coolers to keep the temperatures cool for those folks. And making decisions if they have to, if they don't feel they can keep their residents safe, you know, looking at alternative evacuations if they need to move to another building that has power restored. Those are the types of decisions that are being made.
Kristen Knapp, Director of Communications for the Florida Healthcare Association. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. An American dentist's killing of Cecil the Lion, a collared 13-year-old lion monitored by the University of Oxford in Zimbabwe, sparked widespread outrage and condemnations of big game hunting. But Trophy, a new documentary by filmmakers Shaul Schwartz and Christina Cluzo, offers a more complex perspective on trophy hunting as an industry that blurs the lines between big game hunting and wildlife conservation. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
People are confused how hunting and conservation go together.
You can just pick whatever animal you want from the menu that they offer you, see the price, and book the kill.
Big cats in 21 and 22, sold!
Trophy shows how a billion-dollar big game industry is financing the breeding of endangered species by exploiting a small percentage of these animals for the thrill of the kill, while conserving the rest and restoring their numbers in ranches, says filmmaker Shaul Schwartz.
That's kind of the idea of utilizing animals in this, if it pays, it stays way. Now, is that the answer? I don't know. I'm here to raise questions, but I think what we should do in this subject is be less quick to judge and scream.
Crocodiles are really mean. Besides that, I want a pair of boots.
Filmmaker Christina Clouzot says big game hunting caters to the rich, most of them Americans.
I couldn't believe that it was so vast and that you could buy hunts and you could buy your insurance and you could buy your clothing and your gear, everything for the safari.
Prices range from $8,000 for a buffalo to $45,000 for an elephant and $350,000 for a rhino. This big money industry helps the local communities where the hunts take place and discourages poaching, says Chris Moore, an anti-poaching campaign manager from Zimbabwe. He says while poaching destroys 30,000 elephants a year in Africa just for their tusks, trophy hunting kills 1,100 elephants annually, providing local communities with their meat and revenue.
Half of that trophy fee goes back in to building a clinic or school or whatever the community decides. They have committees and a trust which organizes where that goes.
But animal rights organizations do not see eye to eye with Moore. Associate Director of Campaigns for PETA, Ashley Byrne, condemns the big game industry.
Selling an endangered animal's life to raise money for conservation is like selling a child on the black market to raise money for an anti-trafficking organization. The logic is absurd. The best way to promote conservation is to protect animals' natural habitats and to invest in ecotourism, in non-invasive forms of tourism that do make these animals commodities, but alive, not dead.
But Chris Moore says if trophy hunting were banned, the animals would no longer be seen as commodities to preserve, and poaching would increase.
When you're struggling to feed your child, you look for alternative means. I think if society maintained certain levels of prosperity, and I don't think we would really see poaching.
Trophy offers a vivid cinematic experience of wildlife in Africa while allowing for a chilling look into a vigorous big game hunt industry, starting with the hunter's enigmatic psyche.
This is my trophy, and there's not any bureaucrat that can take it away from me.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Sounds very interesting, that. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States joins the United Nations Security Council in strongly condemning what the Security Council called in a statement the heinous and cowardly terrorist attack that took place on September 11, 2017, on an Egyptian security convoy near Al-Arish in northern Sinai. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack that left at least 18 policemen dead and others injured. Roadside bombs were reportedly used to destroy several military vehicles in the convoy. It was the deadliest attack on Egyptian security forces in months. Those forces have been waging battle against Islamic State terrorists for years, resulting in the deaths of both police and military. In a statement, members of the Security Council affirmed that terrorism in all its forms and manifestations constitutes one of the most serious threats to international peace and security. They underlined the need to bring perpetrators, organizers, financiers, and sponsors of these reprehensible acts of terrorism to justice and urged all states, in accordance with their obligations under international law and relevant Security Council resolutions, to cooperate actively with the government of Egypt and all other relevant authorities in this regard. In addition, the Security Council reiterated that any acts of terrorism are criminal and unjustifiable, regardless of their motivation, wherever, whenever, and by whosoever committed. In a separate statement on the attack in Egypt, State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert expressed the United States' profound condolences to the families and friends of the victims, and our wishes for a speedy recovery for those hurt in the attack. Spokesperson Nauert said, we will continue to stand with Egypt as it confronts the threat from terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.